Good evening, and welcome to tonight's live telephone town hall with Congressman Sam Farr. This new technology allows Congressman Farr to chat with hundreds of his Central Coast neighbors while sitting here in his office in Washington. In a few moments, we'll be joined by the Congressman, but first, I'd like to explain what will happen during our call together. At any time during the call, if you would like to ask Congressman Farr a question, please press star 3 on your telephone. You will continue to hear the conference call until one of our town hall assistants can join you and take your question. Please be ready to give them your name, your city, and what your question is. This will allow us to keep the discussion flowing and reduce repeat topics. And if we can't get to your question during the call, you will also have a chance to leave a voice message for the Congressman at the end of the call. It's a little extra incentive to join us for the whole hour. And finally, a recording of this teleconference will be available on our website tomorrow morning, so feel free to visit www.far.house.gov and listen. Now, I would like to introduce Congressman Sam Farr. He has served the Central Coast for more than 30 years as a county supervisor, state representative, and now congressman. And again, if you would like to ask the congressman a question at any time, please press star 3 and a call screener will be with you shortly. And now, joining us is Congressman Farr. Congressman?
Good evening. This is Sam Farr, and I'm in my D.C., Washington, D.C. office on this spring night here in the summer of in our nation's capital, and I just want to thank you all for joining this unique technology of being able to be here in my office in Washington while Congress is in session, at the same time talking to you in your home in the district. I really like this technology, and I hope you do too. I also want to remind everybody that I'd rather be speaking to you in person, and I will have that opportunity to do so in August when Congress is in recess, and I'll be having my annual town hall meetings throughout the district. And I hope you will join me in those evenings as well. I thought what we'd do tonight is to begin just telling you a little bit about what's happening here in Washington and then just open up to questions that you may have on any issue, and I look forward to those. Congress has been in session since January, and we will continue. We will break in August and come back after August and then finish, and every member of the House of Representatives is up for re-election this year. So it's going to be a fast year and probably end up having to come back in a lame duck session. We've been accomplishing a lot. I'm not sure that that gets across in the media in America, but the House has passed 193 key pieces of legislation. And more than 70% of those have passed with significant bipartisan support. We signed into law the bipartisan economic stimulus package, and I hope by now all of those of you who filed that your taxes have gotten a rebate check. If you indeed qualified, there's about 130 million families that receive those rebate checks, anywhere from $600 to $1,200 for a couple filing jointly. If you're having any problems with those, please let my office know and we will look into it. I also, I'm on top of issues that our district's a hot place right now. It's a lot of fires burning. We have 800 fires burning in California, many of which are in areas which you can't even reach, and they're not threatening houses, so they're letting them burn because they just don't have enough personnel. We have some serious fires burning on the Big Sur coast, and they are threatening homes in Big Sur, and we have a lot of effort to try to contain those fires as rapidly as possible. We're also very worried, everybody's worried, as I am, about these gas tax prices, gas pump prices. I have filled up my wife's car the other day. She drives an old late model Jeep, and it was $100 to fill that car up. And I'm just thinking of all the people that rely on their cars to get to work, take their kids to school, and so on, and the cost of trying to ship goods and services throughout this country. It is a real problem. We have some solutions here in Congress. I don't think they're immediate enough or drastic enough, and I have some ideas of my own in a three-pronged plan, which I can discuss if anybody wants to ask questions about it. But I want to also point out that the idea that we're going to drill our ways out of this by just opening up offshore oil drilling and is not the solution. One, it takes many, many years to get all that infrastructure in place. And two, it doesn't produce that much oil. And three, it doesn't do anything to be out of getting us off of our dependence on oil. And if indeed our biggest problem is the America is the largest consumer of oil in the world, and we have other growing countries that are going to be competing with that oil, driving up the price, we're just going to have to get out of being so dependent on it. We know how to do that. We did that with water on the Monterey Peninsula. California has led the United States in reduction of use of energy per capita. We're the lowest per capita energy using state in the United States. And I think that we can. It's going to be tough, but we're going to get through this craziness, and we're going to come up with some incredible technologies and alternative energies that will be really healthy for the whole planet. We've just gone through local primary elections and preparing for the national election in November, and I hope all of you who are listening are registered to vote and will participate in this process. I'd like to, at this time, just kind of open it up to any questions you might have, because this is your hour, not mine, and I would love to hear what your concerns are, and I'll be glad to address them. So if we could start the questioning, I'll look forward to responding.
Thank you, Congressman. Now we're going to move to our question and answer session. As we have more people joining the call, for those of you who just arrived, to ask the Congressman a question, please press star 3, and a town hall assistant will be with you shortly. Congressman, I would like to start the Q&A session with a question that has made big news locally last week, the light brown apple moth. Can you tell us what happened last week and what role you played?
Well, I've been very worried about the spraying of the pheromone on the light brown apple moth because it's really driven up an awful lot of concern and reaction, and I think that I do believe that the light brown apple moth is a pest that needs to be eradicated, and I think we can eradicate it. I think there are alternative ways, and really what the breaking news is that the state, and it was obviously motivated by lawsuits filed in both Monterey and Santa Cruz County, but no one was looking at, okay, if you're not going to be able to spray right away, it doesn't stop it forever. It just says you have to go through in the environmental documentation, and then you could probably begin spraying, is what do you do for Plan B? And that Plan B has been announced, and it's a good one. It uses biologicals of sterilized moths and a wasp, which is the enemy of the moth, and releasing those into the environment, plus, again, using the pheromone, the stickers that will be applied manually around the counties. And hopefully that will be able to curtail this moth, and we won't have to go to more drastic means. But I'm very excited that finally we got the federal and state government to come up with a different plan than just spray, spray, spray.
Thank you very much, Congressman. We have a few questions beginning to pop up, and for those callers just joining us, I'd like to remind you to press star 3 if you would like to ask the Congressman a question, and a call screener will be with you shortly. For our next question, we're going to go to Elizabeth Stetler from Marina. She has a question about gang issues and moving to coastal areas. Elizabeth?
Yes. I'd like to know what type of programs are available. As a teacher, I don't, in my campus, we have a lot of students are into gangs, and they're finding that to be a place to, something to do, to join the gang, because that's the thing. What are we, the society, doing in Monterey County to address these killings that are happening in Salinas? Because I drive to Salinas every day, but I won't shop there. And someone says, well, why don't you shop Salinas? Are you kidding? With 15 murders there? And where I teach is very close to the east side, and I just come home. Now,
which
I'm
school, Elizabeth, which school district do you?
Salinas Union High School District.
Okay. Well, it's a very good question because it is a crisis, and in fact, there are higher mortality rates and gang shootings in Salinas than there is in San Jose, which is a city of five times the population of Salinas, and it is a very difficult problem because these gangs have become very sophisticated. They are essentially cartels, and they do a lot of bad things because they make money illegally through drugs, illegal arms, and other ways of getting revenue. Our cities, particularly Salinas and East Salinas, is very crowded, overcrowded. Many families living in one house. Kids have to play in the street. There's a gang mentality in the street that it starts off as sort of a social gang or club, and then as one gets older, becomes a much more sophisticated. And we have been addressing it with putting federal money into both the law enforcement side and in the treatment side, which is to try to find these kids who are beginning to drop out of school, get low grades, have low self-esteem, kids that would float into gangs, and working with probation department, education department, and everyone else to take them out of the neighborhood and get them into alternative programs. And that's the Silver Star program. It's working very, very well. I think we've also been able to bring in the Immigration Service with law enforcement and take some of these people out because they are undocumented, and we can get them right out of the country very rapidly with law enforcement and the federal officers coming in. We've just appropriated today in the appropriations bill $1.25 million for the city of Salinas to work on this. This will be matched by state and federal money. I don't know exactly how much, but I think that, frankly, this is and I'm glad you asked, because you don't, you don't live in Salinas, but it is a problem for the whole county. I mean, if there's a gang problem in Salinas, it affects the Monterey Peninsula as well. For the reasons you talked about, you won't go to shop in there, and that gang violence can be exported. Yeah, we're trying to work to find every possible way to, one, do prevention, and two, try to curtail the gang activity as much as we possibly can. And I can tell you that the city of Salinas, this is their highest priority.
Thank you very much, Congressman. Callers, remember, if you have a question for the Congressman, please press *3 at any time during the call, and somebody will be with you shortly. Our next question comes from Vincent from Seaside, who has a question about impeachment. Vincent, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Hello, Congressman Farr. Thank you for taking the question, and thank you for representing the peninsula so well in Congress. I'd just like to ask if you supported the articles of impeachment that have been recently brought to the House floor by Representative Kucinich and then supported by Representative Wexler from Florida.
I've been very supportive. As you know, that we haven't had a vote on that at all. It was brought up, introduced, I think it was last week. It was referred to the Committee of Jurisdiction, which is the Judiciary Committee. I just might add that I don't think that in the time left, as I pointed out earlier, we have about 2 months of session left, 2.5 months at the most. And we're just not impeachment. It's a complicated process. You have a two-part system. The House of Representatives under the Constitution serves as the sort of the grand jury. Our job is to hear the articles of impeachment and to vote on those articles. And then if we do have a list, as we did when the Republicans were in charge and had Ken Starr as the special counsel, that process in the Judiciary Committee took several years. In fact, as I look back on it, the whole process took about 4.5 years to conclude by the time the House had voted on it and gotten over to the Senate, and then the Senate was to try the president on the impeachment articles, and as you know, they acquitted him from the articles that the House adopted. I'm a co-sponsor of the legislation, and I really believe that this administration has done wrong and should be held accountable for it. I'm told by the chairman of the Judiciary Committee that if indeed a crime has been committed by an elected official, even though that elected official leaves office, it does not make them immune from later on being prosecuted for that crime.
Thank you very much, Congressman. Callers, remember, if you have a question for Congressman Farr at any time during the call, press *3, and you will be able to still hear what's going on, and somebody will be with you to take your question shortly. Our next question comes from Grace Darcy from Carmel Valley. She has a question about the FISA bill and telecom immunity. Grace?
Hi. How are you doing, Congressman?
Very well. Thank you for calling in and listening in and asking a question.
Yes, thank you. It's nice of you to take the time to answer them, and I appreciate it. The Congress, an agreement, as they said, has passed that FISA bill, FISA, which will give anybody the right to tap in and listen to our conversations, and the heck with us, as long as they get along. I'm sorry. I feel this is a terrible invasion and a total violation of the Constitution, and I'd like to know your take on it.
Well, the FISA bill, as you mentioned, stands for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It's a bill that authorized, it's a law that we have, and then we amended the law. It sunsetted, and we revised it. I happen to be voting against it, and which is, I think, what
you
wanted me to do. It is.
Yes.
It's a system that is set up that allows not anybody, but specified law enforcement to get a wiretap warrant, which they have to go to a judge and get that. There is a third-party requirement. We have that in all wiretaps. You can't just tap somebody's phone at random. In fact, if somebody tried it, that is a crime. It's the only way you can get to that is to have approval of a judge. This did not. It made some minor issues regarding telephone companies to hold them liable if they had misused or had cooperated without following the law. But the immunity is not strong enough. That's one of the reasons that I mean, not immunity is strong, but the penalties aren't strong enough. And so I voted against it. I think that. Legal surveillance has to be followed precisely by the law, and we should never give up the Americans' ability to have a right to privacy and not have the government snooping on them.
Thank you very much, Congressman. Remember, callers, if you have a question for Congressman Farr, press *3 anytime during the call, and someone will be with you shortly. Our next call is from Jim Costello, who has a question about tax incentives for hybrid cars. Jim, you're live with Congressman Farr. Jim?
Hello?
Jim?
Hey, hello there.
How are you?
Good. Good. How you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for calling in, on a question.
Well, you know, we could sure use some more incentives out there for getting gas guzzlers off the road, and right now you buy a hybrid and you have to be one of a select number or you don't get the incentive. And, I could sit down and build a car that'll get 180 miles per gallon. My Prius from Pacific Grove to San Jose at 52.
Is this Jim Costello?
Yeah.
Oh, I knew it was Jim. I didn't know I didn't hear the last name. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm great at the moment.
That's good. And being a former mayor is okay?
Oh, it's better to be former than be one at the moment. Anyway.
No, yeah, I know you're interested in this issue. Well, thank you for your public service. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you.
Well, yeah, I think that you and I would agree on all of these issues about trying to create as many incentives as possible. I mean, you're lucky that you live in a state that's really excited about this and trying to provide incentives. Those the hybrid diamond lane issue is one that California's passed. I don't know if other states have done that yet. Certainly more consumers of hybrid cars and buyers in California than any other state. We've reduced our personal consumption of energy more than any other state in California. So we're on the right track, and I think California as a state has done a lot of things to provide incentives for alternative technology, because the only way we're going to survive and be able to reduce our footprint. And those, frankly, will become market models for the rest of the United States, because so many people live in California and we consume so much that if indeed we can do this and it shows the rest of the country we can do it. The federal government is way behind. We have passed some bills to invest in alternative technology. We're still having some fights in the Senate with that, and certainly with the president. But I think that it's nuts not to go full steam ahead with every kind of interesting idea that might lead to commercial production. The brain trusts of this country are, I think, reside in California. And you give us a challenge, and we can solve it. We're not going to bring down this gas price right away. And the idea that we should just drill our way out of it just doesn't make any sense. It's sort of we're addicted to gasoline, and we've got to get off that addiction. We shouldn't make the penalty be on everybody that has to get to work and needs their car for that purpose. We are doing a lot of other incentives on mass transit, on ridership, on investments, and requiring that automobiles and trucks have much higher standards. But those are many years off before they have to meet those standards. I think the foreign manufacturers of cars are going to be way ahead of the American manufacturer just because they get it and we don't. Nonetheless, I can tell you there isn't anything discussed more in Congress right now than the whole issue of energy and oil dependence.
Thank you very much, Congressman. Callers, remember that at any time during the call, if you would like to ask Congressman Farr a question, please press *3 on your telephone. You will continue to hear the conference call until one of our town hall assistants can join you and take your question. Our next question comes from Mary. She has a question about Medicare reimbursement. Mary, you are
live. Hi, Congressman Farr. This is Mary Goblersh in Pacific Grove, and I'm calling about the status of any changes in the Medicare reimbursement rate, which is particularly a crisis for seniors accessing medical care in Monterey Peninsula. And I know
I'm very aware of the issue. I've been working on it for about 6 years. And the problem is that Monterey and Santa Cruz County and about five other counties in California that are considered high-cost counties to live in, the doctors in those counties don't receive the highest reimbursement rate that counties like the San Francisco Bay Area counties and Los Angeles counties receive. And therefore, you're really at a disadvantage. And the most obvious difference in this price is between Santa Cruz County, which is the same as Monterey County, and Santa Clara County, which is the same as San Francisco, is the difference between is the highest in the United States in Santa Clara and the lowest in the United States for Santa Cruz. So there's about a $50 per patient difference in seeing Medicare patients. So you can see what doctors are doing. If they're taking Medicare, they'd rather take them in Santa Clara County than Santa Cruz County, and not in Monterey either. So we've been trying to get the formula changed, and it's been a real struggle. We have some amendments and bills. They get in the last minute when they're trying to look at the big issues, which is there's a across-the-board 10% cut at the end of this month, and Congress is this week going to try to delay that cut. Because that would have even a bigger effect. We're just trying to get the doctors in Monterey and Santa Cruz County to get the same reimbursement they do in Santa Clara and San Francisco. So I'm working on it. It's called the Gypsy Fix, and that stands for geographical, I'm not exactly sure. I always forget how we spell out Gypsy, but it's the geographic practice cost index, and that's the cost index is what doctors should get reimbursed in a geographical area. And if we can get these nine counties up to the same geographical cost that the Bay Area counties have, I think it will incentivize doctors to provide more services to Medicare recipients.
Thanks for that question. Remember, if you have a question for Congressman Farr, press *3 on your phone at any point during the call, and somebody will be with you shortly. Our next call is from James from Monterey. He has a question about nuclear energy as a fuel source. James?
Yes, hello.
Hi, James.
Hi there. I'd like to know your thoughts on nuclear energy plants here. looking at Europe, where their technology has grown and ours hasn't?
Well, it's a very good question. And way back when Carter was president and he came from a nuclear submarine command, they made the choice along with the advice of the United States military and other government officials that the American process, the American method for processing uranium would be a lot more secure and safer than that they're using in Europe. And the, as I understand it, what Europe has is a system that is at one point more dangerous in a security sense, that people could take the uranium and use it for weapon grade, or convert it into weapon grade material. We don't allow that in the United States. But the benefit of the European is that they have a much cleaner end product than we do in the United States. We have not. We have a lot of politics involved in it. As you know, a process was went through Congress and was decided by states as to where a regional deposit site should be. That was chosen in the West to be Yucca Mountain. The Nevadans are now on, and I understand Senator McCain was there today talking about it. They certainly don't want it, you know, not my backyard, even though a lot of interest has been taken into making sure that that place will be secure. I think so that you have a disposal problem, and until we can solve that, you're not going to have any incentives to develop new nuclear power. There's also, we've had problems with power plants, and so the insurance for them has gone off the skyrocketed. And you find that although people are very curious about it, there's not a lot of industrial market support for it yet. It's not off the table. People are certainly discussing it, and I think you're going to see in some of these energy alternative packages that continuing research and problem solving will be addressed. But I just don't see it as something that Americans are looking to right now as the panacea for the energy problem.
Thank you very much, Congressman. For those callers just joining us, I'd like to remind you to press *3 if you would like to ask the Congressman a question. Our next question comes from Maxine Stewart from Carlson Pebble Beach about public education. Maxine, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Hi, Congressman Farr. Thank you for taking my phone call. And I think it's wonderful that you're doing this and just taking questions, you know, and not knowing a question you might get next. It's just a wonderful discussion. I live in Pebble Beach, and I'm a public school administrator, a principal. I've been doing
that
for 14 years.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, you know, I love it. And it's been in our family for many generations to serve in public schools. And when we hear discussion about Republicans and Democrats needing to work together and coming across the aisle for different services such as national security or the environment, we don't hear a lot of talk in the public press about needing to work together for public education. And I know, and we all know, common sense is that we need to invest in our children, and that's our future. What ideas do you have so that we could make our public institutions something that, as Americans and Californians, that we're proud of?
Well, it's a terrific question, because it's in our national security that we have a well-educated electorate, and we find that we are falling behind competitive countries around the world. Once we lose that creative seed corn that America seems to have, the inventiveness, the excitement, the ability to be artistic, and is that we will no longer be an economic giant. We'll be subservient to all these ideas and products and things that are coming out of other countries. So investment in education is a part of our national and economic security. The difference in America is that we don't have any national education system. We have the system left up to 50 states. So there's 50 different public education systems in K-12. And as you know from a teacher, we've tried to address that through the categorical funding that schools get for special ed and migrant ed and Head Start and things like that, where the federal government does step in. And we did that with Leave No Child Behind, which was trying to figure out how these states were comparing, measuring against each other, even though they're using different kinds of testing. And this has had a very negative background because it's led to just teaching to the test and sort of getting rid of all the other things that stimulate students, as art and music and so on. The bill to reauthorize No Child Left Behind has... is stuck. It's probably not going to pass this year, although the president really wants it badly, because he is hung up on this testing, and the Congress is trying to find some alternative ways. We do have the one program that addresses a lot of special kids' needs is the special education. Unfortunately, we don't fund enough of that. We fund the law, I think, requires that the federal government make up to 40%. Of the funding available, and I think we're about 19%. So what happens is schools have to dip into their pocket and take funds out of the general fund to run the school and put it into the special ed program, and they're always mad that the feds don't put in enough and that the state doesn't put in enough. However, it's a very successful program, and we are increasing that funding because your opening comment about sort of the bipartisan or nonpartisan, the fact that we work together, I think that in these categorical aid programs, Congress is not split on them at all. We really all want to invest in our children. We have different ideas on how to do that through private or public education and so on. But my hope is that the next president, and perhaps that even in this debate for presidents, that we will see a debate just around education itself. What we can do in this country to motivate governors to really get serious about upgrading education throughout the United States, and at the same time, Congress adequately funding it.
Thanks for that question. Remember, if you have a question for Congressman Farr, press *3 on your phone at any point during the call. You'll still be able to hear what's going on, and someone will be with you to take your question shortly. Our next question comes from Rachel Grout from Pacific Grove. Her question is about gang violence. Rachel, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Wow, Congressman Farr, it's an honor to speak with you. This is a fantastic way to involve the public and teaching and such.
Thank you.
My question is to do with the education and also with gang violence. I find that there aren't a whole lot of technical schools around. Maybe some of the funds some of the funds that are allocated to gang prevention and things could go towards trade schools and something to actually train these folks in jobs that don't necessarily require a higher education.
Well, first of all, you said you lived in Pacific Grove? I think it's very important that the peninsula be very concerned about the gangs issues, even though the predominance of it is in Salinas, because I do think that we are all affected by it. And what we've tried to do is working with the city of Salinas and the county of Monterey and some other cities, the Seaside's been involved in some South County cities, is kind of a two-pronged approach. First, we've really worked with law enforcement in getting federal, state, and local law enforcement all on the same page about how to adequately enforce and go after the violent perpetrators and the committers of crime and do as much intervention as we can. We're also working in prevention, and that is an early intervention where we take the kids that are at risk and bring them out of the neighborhood and out of the school and take them to a specialized area where they get a much better education because it's one-on-one. And I've interviewed a lot of these kids, and it's just turned their lives around. We need to get them jobs so that they don't fall back into sort of the culture of poverty. We've created a gang violence and task force in Monterey County. It's countywide. It was created back in March of 2005. It's made up of the Sheriff's Department, the Probation Department, the District Attorney's Office, and the Salinas Police Department, and the California Highway Patrol. I've gotten millions of dollars in federal aid to help that task force, and $350,000 of that was released just today, as I recall. we have a we're bringing in other assets such as mobile fingerprinting and facial recognition system, because these gangs are very sophisticated. They're not just local gangs. They're connected to the Sorteño gangs of the south and the Sorteño gangs of the north, and they're run out of Pelican Bay prison in Northern California. And essentially these gangs are our local terrorism. And I'm just trying to do everything I can to work with everybody who's involved, including the suggestions you have about giving them access to other kinds of training. You still have to be able to read and write and have some math skills to operate equipment that if you're going to be into, machinery, mechanic, and stuff like that. The trade schools are requiring a lot more sophistication and basic education. So we can't stop preparing them for being able to be able to hold these blue-collar jobs. And this is one of those things, if we're going to really stop this, it's going to take the whole village to, and I think most of all, it's going to take everybody realizing that it's a problem, that we've all got to be part of helping the solution and not just sort of blame it on, oh, it's over there in another town and we don't have to worry about it.
Thank you very much. Again, for those callers just joining us, I'd like to remind you to press *3 if you'd like to ask the congressman a question. Our next question comes from Victor Crane from Carmel Woods about federal oil leasing. Victor, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Great. Hey, thank you very much for holding this meeting. This is really nice. I had read about Nick Rahal, who's a Democrat from West Virginia,
yep.
Representative, House Resolution 6251, that forces the oil companies to drill the leases that they already have, an equivalent of 68 million acres the size of Colorado is ready to be drilled right now. Now,
yes.
my position is that I'm against drilling. You said it yourself, we can't drill our way to oil independence. My question is, why do not the Democrats, who are so good behind the scenes, can't take it to the front stage and make their argument to the public that drilling on the coast that the Republicans want to do is nothing more than a political stunt, and I think they could win the election on it. Yet the Democrats just sit on their hands and do nothing to confront the Republicans, saying, hey, make it public that they've got the 68 million acres to drill, and yet we're trying to force them to do so. I know that because I read, but a lot of those people don't.
First of all, the Democrats have seized the moment, and Nick Rahal is the chair of the Resources Committee, which has jurisdiction on all this drilling, and what his bill is use it or lose it. You're out there trying to run these ads and have the President of the United States and everybody else say, just drill, 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 wherever it is. And the Democrats are responding and say, hey, wait a minute, oil companies, you've leased from the federal government these lease sale sites, and you're just sitting on top of it. And if you're going to complain you want to drill, then drill what you already own and drill now. And don't just try to buy more land or get more leases and then sit on them. They're by not drilling, they're driving up the price. And they have plenty of, as you pointed out, they have plenty of access to those leased areas. In California, in Northern California, there isn't any leased site, so it's not about drilling in the National Marine Sanctuary. It would probably allow some more drilling in the Santa Barbara Channel, but there are methods now where they don't have to build any more rigs. They can do that by slant drilling, and I think even Santa Barbara is looking at the possibilities, because of the revenue that would be derived, of allowing some very environmentally sensitive access to but they have the infrastructure already in. So there's a battle going on here in Congress, and it's sort of this mentality of, let's just drill, 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 drill our way out of it everywhere. I mean, we joke that if there were oil under the United States Capitol, they'd want to remove Congress and just put a big rig there. But as you said, the answer isn't just if we can get some more domestic supply in the short term, we won't have to rely so much on imported oil. We don't even know if the refining capacity is there. You have a lot of these refineries that they haven't built any new ones. Can they take any more oil? So it doesn't matter whether oil comes from the Middle East or from California or Monterey. If they don't have the capacity to refine it, then we're not going to have a better supply at the pump. And Well, I think that, frankly, that the real long-term issue is America's just got to get less dependent on oil. We can't ask the citizens to have to solve that problem, but we certainly, as citizens, are using their pocketbook to buy hybrid cars, to figure out other ways of carpooling, and, as you know, the use of buses and the metro systems, which are publicly funded, are way up, and that's good. So I think, and as I told an earlier caller, my God, I'd ask the Monterey Peninsula about how you can conserve. We have set the world record on water use, on the small water use, the conservation of water. We haven't had any new meters since 1978 on the peninsula, and look at the growth that's been sustained just on water conservation. And we've also in California learned after the energy crisis that California was the lowest per capita consumer of energy in the United States. So I think we are a state that knows how to respond to a crisis and also to find solutions for the long term. And I think we ought to do that. I've also suggested that we take kind of a radical approach. I think that we have to do something immediately. I think we ought to impose a freeze on gas prices, keep them from climbing. That would be an immediate solution. I think the medium-term solution would be rescind the tax breaks. We're giving $17 billion to the oil companies. They certainly don't need tax breaks when the price of oil is $130 a gallon. We need a windfall profits tax. We passed that in the House. It's gotten blocked in the Senate. And then for the long-term solutions, I think Congress must use its power to, in the law, to stop filling the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We could release, if we're not filling it, we can then that oil could be used on the market instead of storing it. And we have passed a gas price relief for consumers, which would allow the prosecution of anti-competitive conduct by oil cartels like OPEC. And we've also passed the Renewable Energy and Job Creation Act to create hundreds of thousands of new green energy jobs. So we are responding, and one of the ways you're seeing that the debate here in Congress is to open it up just to drill anywhere there's oil or to make sure that the oil companies use what they have or lose it.
Thanks for that question. Callers, remember, if you have a question for the congressman, please press *3 anytime during the call, and someone will be with you shortly. Our next question is from Dan Presser from Monterey, who has a question for the congressman about Cuba. Dan?
Hey, Congressman Farr.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about you? You sound pooped.
Well, it's about 10:30 back here almost, so I'm a little bit tired, but I hope I didn't sound that sound that way.
No, you're an incredible guy, and we appreciate you. Listen, I just got back from a humanitarian trip to Cuba, and I have seen, you know, that the Platt Amendment is just hurting the average Cuban. What do you think can be done to repeal that? Because it seems like the former Cubans who are living in Miami are just too powerful, and they're very right-wing, and the poor people of Cuba are being hurt.
Well, the what you're seeing here in Washington, and certainly hearing in Florida, is that times are a changing. The sons and daughters of the Cubans who were so anti having any relationship with Cuba are sort of telling their parents, "Get over it. We want those relations." Today, Congress, in our appropriations process, we just amended. You know, the administration has, by rulemaking, has banned any Cuban American citizen from traveling to Cuba more than once every 3 years, and only a limited family can go. And we've lifted that. It's not total lift, but it's down to they can go a much more extended family, and they can go at least once every year. We've also lifted today the ban on some trade provisions. We have a lot of farmers that want to grow food for Cuba, and Cuba wants to pay for it, and they pay for it in dollars. And I think most of us in Congress, not most of us, but a good number of us in Congress feel that we ought to get rid of all the sanctions on Cuba. It's 90 miles off our coast. It's a small island. Tourism, you know, if you want Cubans to have a different form of government, just flood the place with American and Canadian tourists. And in fact, the Canadians and Europeans can go there, and the Europeans have been debating this last week on lifting all sanctions against Cuba. So I think America is finding itself further and further out of step with the rest of the world, and I think this crazy failed policy we've had about Cuba for the last 40 years is about to dramatically change.
Thank you very much, Congressman. Our next question comes from Luke Wright from Seaside. He has a question about Fort Ord. Luke?
How are you doing, Congressman?
Hi, Luke. Thanks for the question.
Let me first say that this is an awesome forum. This is probably the most worthwhile unsolicited call that I've received in a, in a long time.
Well, thank you.
Fort Ord, I guess, closed maybe about 13 or 15 years ago. The government has decided to lease the property here to a business that manages the military housing. In order to create funding here, they've allowed civilians to move in to the military housing. However, the military members are not allowed to receive the reduced rental rates that the civilians receive.
I know something about that. I think you're right. We do have a what happened is that when Fort Hood closed, and people think that it totally closed, but what happens, it downsized mostly, and the military still kept land there for housing purposes and for their PX and commissary. And the big hospital building that was there is now a federal office building and has military personnel and defense contractors and civilian workers in it, plus some classes for the Defense Language Institute. I think that the privatization of housing for the military is one of the best things we've ever done, because the military and the government was building lousy housing and nobody wanted to live in it. And what we did is saying to the private sector, we'll lease the land to you, and you build housing that is really modern and attractive and meets the local building code standards and codes. And you can rent it to the soldiers on their, what they're given as a base housing allowance when they're stationed in Monterey. And for an enlisted soldier, it would probably be about $1,100 a month, and for an officer up to about $2,300 a month. And with that's all the rents they can get. And what they and the soldiers do get first claim. If there is no soldier that wants the house after it's built for the interim, until a soldier does take it, they are doing a leasing, I think, mostly to federal employees. But those federal employees have to pay out of their salary. They don't get any housing allowance, those rental rates. So they don't get it. They're not getting a break that the soldiers don't get. In fact, they don't get any break. They get to lease housing at those prices as long as they are a federal employee. They may, if they run out of federal employees, maybe they go down to state employees and local employees as well. But I think in the long run, all of his housing is going to be occupied by students at the Defense Language Institute and the Naval Postgraduate School.
Thank you very much. We have time for a couple more live questions, but remember, for those of you who didn't get a chance to ask your question, you will have a chance to leave a voicemail for the congressman at the end of the call. Our next question comes from Carolyn Salmon from Monterey. She has a question about water plans and rates. Carolyn?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. What a great idea.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if there's been any meaningful progress on a comprehensive water plan for the peninsula and surrounding areas. We seem to be at the mercy of Cal-Am, and we're facing a tripling in our water rates over the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, it's a very good question, and finally, as it's a long time coming, there is a sort of a regional greater than just the Monterey Peninsula. It includes all of the marina area and so on, and it's being developed through the Monterey County Water Management Agency, and Curtis Weeks is the executive director of that, a really outstanding public servant, and would suggest that you might look at their website or talk to Dave Potter or any of the other county supervisors about what they're doing. And essentially what they're looking at is that we have the only privately delivered water on the Monterey Peninsula is Cal-Am. And the water that's delivered in Marina and partially in Seaside and Fort Ord is Marina Coast Water District, which is a public district. They are doing their own mini desalt plant. They've been working on that for years. And there, we have a large reclamation plant where all the sewer from the Monterey Peninsula, except the sewer of Pebble Beach and Carmel, which is treated out by the Carmel River, where they have a sewage treatment plant. But all of those treated sewage waters go back to irrigate golf courses on the Monterey Peninsula. And in north of Marina, all the agriculture between Salinas and the ocean is irrigated by reclaimed water. We have more reclaimed water than we can use, and we just pump it into the ocean. The idea is to try to find more uses in all the common green spaces that could be used, football fields, baseball diamonds, even in the common areas, parks, and so on. And at the same time, freeing up that water that's being used to water those areas and use that water as portable water and connect the system that the Marina Coast Water District has with the Cal-Am distribution system. And what they'll do is they'll be able to produce some more water, but it will keep the water within existing planting growth patterns. I think the big fear of the Monterey Peninsula, and I've been very involved in this all my life, is that everybody wants to have more water because they hate living under rationing and they would like to build another bathroom or something. But at the same time, when they're put on the ballot to approve it, everybody's afraid this is going to stimulate growth and we turn it down. So we're kind of a quixotic mood here on the peninsula. We want more water, but we don't want to pay for it. And I think this system is going to be the most cost-effective and the least price, because Cal-Am, going to the Public Utilities Commission, can get reimbursement for the cost, and they have a lot of big costs. They're having to replace the wells in Carmel Valley. They're not allowed to pump out of those. They have to tear down the San Clemente Dam, which is earthquake unsafe and environmentally a big problem. That's a huge cost. And meanwhile, they have to build a new desal plant somewhere either out in the Marina Dunes or in at Moss Landing. And we, the ratepayers, are going to have to pay for all those very, very expensive actions. So we're trying to figure out how we can make it more cost-effective. And I think the Monterey County Water Agency is coming up with a very good integrated plan.
Thank you very much. Thank you for everybody who called in. We have time for one more live question. And remember, for those of you who didn't get a chance to ask your question, please stay on the line. You will have a chance to leave a voicemail for the congressman at the end of the call. Our final question comes from Bob Rigney from Carmel, who has a question about a veteran cemetery. Bob, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Thank you very much, and Congressman Farr, good evening. And
hi, Bob. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Hansi and I are good. Question on that. Since I'm a Navy veteran, and as Clint Eastwood said, the back nine of life, I'm wondering about this proposal of a cemetery in at the old Fort Ord.
Well, we're making progress on it. As you know, it's been an uphill battle, and it's been for a lot of a bureaucracy that can't be changed, and one of them is the federal, says that we're not going to build, they will not build another federal cemetery within 70 miles of an existing one, which still has space available. And that existing one is over in Santanella, and it's, as the crow flies, about 70 miles. It's certainly awkward and certainly not related to the history of the military anywhere in California or in the Monterey Peninsula, but they won't budge on that. So the federal government does have a plan B where they'll fund states to build essentially cemeteries. And as you've seen through the years, the state of California has indicated they don't want to be in that business, and they won't put the application forward to the Department of Veterans Affairs because they don't want to pay them the maintenance costs, even though the construction cost is all reimbursed by the federal government. So I came up with a plan C, saying, what if we do a private-public partnership? We have the land at Fort Ord. We don't have to buy it. It's in federal ownership right now. What we need is an investor who would come along and build either invest in that land and could build a civilian cemetery, a private cemetery, next to the veteran cemetery, and could maintain the veteran cemetery and therefore at no cost to the state of California. That plan is proceeding. We have a funded feasibility study that's being done right now for the design of the cemetery and the options for operating it. And once that feasibility study is completed, which we hope will be in a few months from now, we can start marketing it to private investors. And once we get the money there, the state will make the application and we can get the construction started. I'm hoping that this will be done as soon as possible because I've been working on this since 1993. So I appreciate your question, and I hope we first of all, I hope you live a long time because you're a great guy, and I don't want to lose you. But I hope it's built, and then you can go out and pick the place you want. And that would be a lot nicer than just having to store your ashes, which a lot of people are doing now, waiting for that cemetery to be constructed.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. Thanks to everybody who called in. And Congressman, would you like to offer any parting thoughts?
Well, I just want to thank everybody who listened in, either for a moment or for the whole program, and all those people, about 13 or 14 of you that asked questions. I wish we'd had time more. I'm going to be out in the district for the month of August, and we'll be doing town hall meetings, and certainly the same format as this, and hopefully you will show up at those. And I just want to conclude by saying that I am prouder than ever of being an American after going around to other countries in the world and watching. Those are, democracies that I've been looking at, and none of them have the direct election like we have, where you really have this contact with your elected official like we've had tonight. And I think that this is an election year, and I can't emphasize enough how important it is for people to register to vote and participate in these elections. We're choosing the leader of the free world, and this next president is going to have more problems on his desk than any president in the history of the United States. And we've got to make sure that we, as a country, get behind and elect somebody who we think can carry this out. So I appreciate your concern, your interest, and your ability to be a good member of our society and an active citizen of the United States. Thank you for participating in an electronic town hall meeting.